This is the election campaign season. There is much we can anticipate. There is much we can expect. But there will also be many surprises. Sometimes a surprise a day. So in surprise, I would say that so far, the biggest surprise tactically and strategically in this campaign has been the BJP making Kachativu, the little island across India's eastern coast in Tamil Nadu, an election issue. An election issue for Tamil Nadu, it would seem, but also nationally, because the point the BJP is trying to make is that the leaders before them, that is the Congress leaders, or more specifically, the Gandhi dynasty. And there's a reason why I say specifically the Gandhi dynasty. I will come to that. That they were callous about India's territorial integrity, that they did not think twice before ceding Indian territory. And that's how this latest controversy suggests. And today, External Affairs Minister Jaishankar himself spoke at the party office. Remember party office. So this was a political statement. And he laid out some details of the agreements according to which Kachativu Island was quote unquote ceded or allowed to become part of Sri Lankan territory. These were two agreements in 1974 and 1976. Now, we try to understand that issue. We will try to understand that issue. And you know what? This will play out like a complex movie. One of those complex, long movies. I'm trying to make it not long today, not too long today. But like one of those complex movies where two stories run alongside. And usually, one runs in the present, one runs in flashback. In this case, maybe two stories run parallelly, one also a little bit in the flashback, because two issues are involved here. One is territory and the other is people. The territory is just about 285 acres or 115 hectares on a good day. On a good day means because this is an island, these are also shallow seas, so tides, there is some territory that you see when high tide is on, some territory you see when the tide recedes, and then water level changes take place also. So the territory at best is about 115 hectares. 115 hectares comes to about 1.15 square kilometers. If you just want to see it in sort of terms that we can easily visualize, it's a bit like the length of two football fields and the width of a cricket field, right? Maybe a little bit longer, again, given the tidal status. So not very much. That is a very small territory. It's a very small territory with no habitation on it, no habitation, very little vegetation barring some shrubbery, because again, these are coral islands. There is very, very little organic matter there. It is, however, a foot in the sea. It's a foot in the sea. And there, in earlier 20th century, some devout Christians also built a little church, a tiny church to Saint Anthony. But it has generally been linked to the diocese of Jaffna. Jaffna, as we know, is in Sri Lanka. Now, this island where nobody lives, it is important because around the island, there's a lot of fishing. So there's a lot of fishing for Sri Lankan fishermen and women. There's also a lot of fishing for Indian fishermen and women. Then, if you see this part of the world and this part of our eastern coast, you will see how complex it is, because the width and the length of what is called as Pok Strait is not very much. The Pok Strait is what divides the part of Bay of Bengal that divides Sri Lanka and India in the Tamil Nadu area. So across Tamil Nadu, Pok Strait is about 64 to 137 kilometers wide. So 64 kilometers to its at its narrowest. So in the past, ferries have been running here between Sri Lanka and India for a long time. Also, there was a time in the distant past, pre-1964, there was a time when a train used to run from Chennai, or what was then Madras, to Dhanushkodi in Tamil Nadu. And from there, you could then transship to the Sri Lankan side and then take a train from Mannar to Colombo. So you could reach from Chennai or then Madras to Colombo like that. The cyclone of 1964 took away most of Dhanushkodi and the train infrastructure. That hasn't been restored since then. I tell you this only so we can understand how close these areas are. Now, if you see this area, these are very shallow seas. First of all, the width of Pox Straits is not that much. Now, what is Pox Straits? That's again a story. When we were growing up in school and we used to listen to All India Radio, Akashwani in Hindi they would say, Pak Jal Damru Madhe. Jal Damru Madhe is very chaste Hindi for a strait, right? So, Pak. So, we used to think, because this was the 1960s, that this has something to do with Pak as in Pakistan. No, it is, this is not Pak. This is Pok. Pok, P-A-L-K. And where does it come from? This comes from the name of Robert Pok. Robert Pok was the governor of Madras between 1755 and 1763 under East India Company. So like many other landmarks in the subcontinent, this one is also named after a colonial either bureaucrat, ruler, general or an explorer. In this case, a colonial bureaucrat or bureaucratic ruler of Madras. That is where the name Pok Strait comes from. Again, I told you how narrow it is, how little the distance is. Its length also is just about 137 kilometers. So its length is about as much as it is wide at its widest. So that is as narrow the area is. Then the important thing is it's very shallow. So again, take a close look at the area and you see this NASA picture. This is the NASA picture of what is what international maps call Adam's Bridge. In the Indian view, it will be Ram Setu. These are the remnants of the bridge according to the widely held belief in India that Lord Ram and his Vanar Sena built in this region to cross from the Indian side to Sri Lankan side to get Sita back and to fight the war with Ravan on the Sri Lankan side. So in the area of Ram Setu or Adam's Bridge, the water level, the water depth is just 1 to 3 meters. That's just a bit like the shallower areas of a swimming pool. This is that shallow. That's why from the satellite, you can see so much of these structures underwater because the level of water is very low. Even then, if you look at the entire Pok Strait, the average depth in deeper areas is 20 meters. That's all. The deepest areas are 35 meters. What that does is, this also makes the proximity of the two countries, of the two coastlines, also the affinity of the populations on both sides, because on both sides, predominantly it's a Tamil population. On the Indian side, entirely Tamil. On Sri Lankan side, mostly Tamil. So there is a lot of familial connections. There is also a lot of toing and froing. There's been gun running in the past. The two navies, Coast Guard also from the Indian side, they've been operating sometimes together, sometimes at contrary purposes, at cross purposes to each other. Since insurgency started in Jaffna in Sri Lanka, both navies and Coast Guard on the Indian side have tried very hard to stop it, barring the early years in 1982, 83, 84, until Mrs. Gandhi's period, when it was generally believed, and I would say this was a correct belief, that Mrs. Gandhi's government was involved in helping Sri Lankan guerrillas or Sri Lankan insurgents against the Sri Lankan government. Now, that's a different story that we'll talk about at some other point of time. In fact, I've talked about some of this and I will share links to some earlier episodes of Karta Clutter on this. Please check those out. Now, with this background, locate this island, uninhabited, nothing grows there. A church, which is just a church, which people visit from both sides, people visit on Christian festivals, which is twice or thrice in a year, no more. But both sides, the fishermen thought that they had the rights to fish in this area. Until 1974, this wasn't such a problem. In 1976, there was an agreement between India and Sri Lanka, which limited Indian fishermen to what was seen then as Indian territory and Indian exclusive economic zone. That is the issue right now. Because what is the BJP saying? What did External Affairs Minister Jay Shankar say today? They say that until 1974, the agreement in 1974 said that was the Indira Sri Mavo agreement. There's a bunch of agreements between India and Sri Lanka that I will come to as we go along. I will give you a listing. But in that agreement, after that agreement, Sardar Swaran Singh, who was External Affairs of India, and before that also, there were commitments, solemn commitments made in Indian Parliament by Congress governments that fishing rights of Indian fishermen had been fully protected in this area. However, with the 1976 agreement, these were given away. So that is the one issue. These agreements have also been attached in some RTI replies that MEA has given to people who have asked questions. So there is one RTI reply of 2015, of which I am sharing a copy with you. There's another RTI reply which just came out very recently in March. And this is the reply that came within a week of a question being asked, an RTI being filed by K. Annamalai, the BJP party chief in Tamil Nadu. So I will share both the links with you, both details with you. So 2015 RTI, for example, MEA said, and this is under Modi government, and I quote from the RTI reply, this did not involve either acquiring or ceding of territory belonging to India, since the area in question had never been demarcated. Under the agreements, the island of Kachativu is on Sri Lankan side of the Indo-Sri Lankan International Maritime Boundary Line. Now, we have to understand what's happening here. Until 1974, Kachativu is an area of contention. It is not an area in Indian control. Since 1921, the island of Kachativu had been under the control of the British Ceylon. Remember, Britain controlled both countries then, India as well as Ceylon, as Sri Lanka was known then. Indian contention is that before that, it is the Raja of Ramnad or Rameshwaram who controlled this area. Sri Lankans, on the other hand, said, oh, 17th century, we controlled this area. We have evidence of that. So those arguments had been going on in the 60s, and there's a lot of documentation. There's a lot of detail and correspondence, which is also available in RTI replies given by MEA. These include a note by Y.D. Gondevia, who was India's foreign secretary in 1961. So this is a note dated 10-5-1961, in which he says India has a legal case on Kachativu, but it's like a 50-50 case at best. And it's better right now, given the instability in Ceylon, that we don't raise this issue. M.C. Settlewad, the Indian Attorney General in 1958, opined that India did have a legal case on this. And also, all those who said that India had a legal case on this, as later the head of the history section in the MEA, they said India has a historical argument. It may not be an argument in its finality, but it is an argument that should be used to get fishing rights for Indians in this area. So that is the detail that the MEA has given out in its RTI replies. Now look at some other things. June 2011, Jayalalitha government in Tamil Nadu. Jaishankar is absolutely correct when he says this is not an issue that's popped up just now. It's an issue that's been sub judice in two cases in Supreme Court. It's also something that Tamil politics has been picking up. Tamil political parties have been picking up from time to time. So June 2011, Jayalalitha had gone to Supreme Court calling this agreement unconstitutional, calling the earlier India-Srimavo agreement and also the follow-on agreement in 1976 signed by the Indian and Sri Lankan foreign secretaries. I will give you dates in just a little bit, as I promised, that because it involved ceding Indian territory but was still not ratified by parliament, this is unconstitutional. So the argument there was that a similar deal on Berubari enclave with Bangladesh, what used to be Pakistan, that had been seen as unconstitutional and requiring of parliamentary approval. Similarly, this needed parliamentary approval, and because it did not have it, it should be held unconstitutional. Government of India appeared through its counsel in Supreme Court in 2014. It was the UPA government then. We have to be very, very careful with timelines. So Feb 2014, Government of India appeared and its counsel said, and I quote, no territory belonging to India was ceded nor sovereignty relinquished since the area was in dispute and had never been demarcated. That's why, because nothing has been ceded, no amendment is required. Once again, read it with what MEA has said in another RTI reply in 2015. In fact, 27 January 2015, under Modi government, I read out that line to you earlier, again saying the same thing. This did not involve either acquiring or ceding of territory belonging to India. Now, the question that's been raised right now is not so much ceding of territory. Modi government has been clever because nobody is saying we'll take territory back, because its own counsel Mukul Rohtagi has said in Supreme Court in response to these cases that you cannot take this territory back short of going to war with Sri Lanka. So that is not the issue that Modi government is making. Of course, they are saying that the Congress governments in the past, particularly Gandhi-Nehru governments, played fast and loose with India's territory. We are not like that. The Jansangh earlier and the BJP is not like that. They give value to every millimeter to India's territory. And that's the political argument. Now, what's happened in 1976, however, is important. And that's where we have to look at this agreement. So I'm giving you one set of timelines right now. Then I will give you the second set. I told you that it'll be like two movies running parallelly. So as far as territory is concerned, Kachatevu is concerned, I told you there were two movies, one about territory and the other about people, right? As far as the territory is concerned, Sri Mavo Indira Pact of 28th June 1974, which said that, all right, Kachatevu falls in territory, which is Sri Lanka's sovereign territory, maritime territory. At the same time, Clause 5 and 6 of that agreement. And you see those agreements on your screen. I'm also sharing links with you. You can read them at leisure. These are very short agreements. Clause 5 and 6 are important. So Clause 5 and 6 say basically that fishermen and women from Indian side will have the freedom to use Kachatevu Island and also the freedom of waters around the island. So similarly, the vessels of either country will be able to go in this area uninterrupted. And also when Indian fisher folk go to this island or Indian pilgrims to go to this island, they will not need any passport or visas. Sri Lankans will not insist on it. Then in 1976, this Sri Mavo Indira Pact was signed on 28th of June 1974. Jaishankar says that before that, Foreign Secretary of India visited Tamil Nadu, briefed Tamil Nadu government about this, Tamil Nadu Chief Minister, who said that, look, I can't be supporting all of these things, but if you make these agreements with Sri Lanka, I understand the value of this in the national interest. I will try and ensure that the protest is kept to the minimum. So it was done like an understanding between the central government and the state government. That's the point the BJP is making, that the Congress and DMK were quote-unquote complicit in this. Then 2 years later, another agreement was signed. Now, this agreement was not signed by the prime ministers. This agreement was signed by the foreign secretaries from both sides. So, Kewal Singh from the Indian side, W.T. Jayasinghe from the Sri Lankan side. This agreement now demarcated the maritime boundaries between the two countries. In this agreement, the freedom that Indian fisher folk had earlier of access to Kachatevu, that no longer existed. Because this now said that each side will be in full control, full sovereign control of the territory that it owns. So 23rd March 1976, this was signed. In July 1976, by the way, a follow-on agreement was signed where Maldives also became a party. And that was the India-Sri Lanka-Maldives agreement marking out the Trijunction. So this first agreement, so this 1976 23rd March agreement, which is the contentious one, which took away the Indian fisher folks' rights to Kachatevu. Along with this agreement, there was another agreement getting Indian fisher folk the right to fish in something called the wedge area. The wedge area, which is lower down, not far from Kanyakumari, closer to that area, so further south from Ram Setu area. That agreement also said that if hydrocarbons are found there tomorrow and India explores, then India will inform the Sri Lankans and Sri Lankans will stop fishing there. So India will be able to explore the economic benefit of mining and hydrocarbons in that area. This agreement also is appended in the same RTI reply. Clause 5.2 of the 1976 agreement is what is the cause of contention now. So earlier, the 1974 agreement gave Indian fisher folk the right to go to Kachatevu, no problem. Now it said, clause 5, subclause 2, and I quote, each party shall have sovereignty over historic waters and territorial sea, as well as the islands falling on the side of the aforesaid boundary. And then it follows on, number 3, subclause 3, each party party shall respect the rights of navigation, that's rights of the other side, right of navigation through its territorial sea and exclusive economic zone in accordance with international law. Now, you might ask me that if 1974, this agreement had been signed already, which allowed fisher folk the freedom of navigation in that area, there was the need to sign one more agreement in 1976. So what is it that happened between 1974 and 1976? And that is something that you are not seeing in the debate so far. So 1976 it is that countries started defining their territorial waters and exclusive economic zones, because that is when India had also decided that they were going to sign UNCLOS, that is UNCLOS, that the United Nations Convention on Laws of the Seas, right? That is what everybody is now trying to hold the Chinese to in South China Sea, although mind you, or never mind, that the Americans have not yet ratified it. In 1976, India passed an important law. This was the Territorial Waters, Continental Shelf, Exclusive Economic Zones and Other Maritime Zones Act of 1976. This is the emergency government of Mrs. Gandhi, of Indira Gandhi. They passed this law in June 1977. By this time, it is Morarji Desai's Janata government. June 1977, India ratified UNCLOS. Before ratifying UNCLOS, you had to also define your maritime boundaries. It was in the process of that definition of maritime boundaries that this follow-on 1976 agreement with Sri Lanka was signed. It's important for us to, I know it's a bit cluttered and I'm trying to keep it as simple as possible, but these are complex issues. These issues are not just about a little bit of trading in territory. These are not feudal times. We are living in a world that is governed by international laws, in which 70s is the time when one of these laws India decided to embrace, and India has continued to be in that law, in the embrace of that law since then. And when India now, even at Quad and other places, talks about freedom of navigation, following international law, laws of the seas, there is reference to this particular law and this particular multilateral global arrangement. Now we come on to our second movie. I can't do it like a really smart filmmaker would do it. A film director would do it, like take two frames from one, two frames from the other, and juxtapose one with the other and move from one to the other. That's a tough one to do in this format. Plus, surely I don't have the talent to do this. So the other agreements to remember, one, Nehru-Kotelawala Pact. John Kotelawala was the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka in 1954. So Nehru-Kotelawala Pact of 18 January 1954. Number two, Shri Mavo Bandaranaike Shastri Pact, 30th October 1964. And then, of course, we move on to Sri Mavo Indira Pact of 28 June 1974, that we've talked about already. That was about Kachetibu Island, but there was an underlying issue there. And that underlying issue harks back to the first two agreements that I talked to you about, that is the Nehru-Kotelawala Pact and Sri Mavo Shastri Pact. Now, when Sri Lanka became independent, same time as India, 1947, Sri Lanka had about 780,000 people, Tamils of Indian origin. Sri Lanka had quite a few Tamils of Sri Lankan origin. That's in Jaffna, or Jaffna Tamils as they are called, Jaffna, Trincomalee, Batticaloa, areas like that. That is mostly north, northeast, like that. But Sri Lanka also had, in the Sri Lankan heartland, the highlands in particular, Kandy and higher than Kandy, the plantation country. Sri Lanka had 780,000 Tamils of Indian origin who were plantation Tamils, who were left stateless as Sri Lanka became independent. As Sri Lanka became independent in 1947, those in power were still Sinhala nationalists. They continue to be in power, and that's been the problem in Sri Lanka. That's been the issue, the ethnic issue, the Sinhala chauvinism, or Sinhala versus Tamil issue. Although we are more familiar with Sinhala versus Jaffna Tamil issue, but just as there was a Sinhala versus Jaffna Tamil issue, there was also an Indian Tamil issue. So 1946-47, there were 780,000 plantation Tamils of Indian origin. How did they get there? They or their parents, or in some cases grandparents, had been shipped by the British to work on coffee and then tea and cardamom and spice plantations in Sri Lanka. That's precisely what they did across the world, from to so many islands in the West Indies, for example, Mauritius, so many places, all kinds of crops the British grew, and they took laborers from India. That's how they took Tamil laborers into Sri Lanka, into Ceylon there. Now, they were stateless. Where would they go? The Sri Lankan Sinhala chauvinist government did not want to give them citizenship and thereby voting rights. Because if they had given them voting rights, then the percentage of Tamils would have gone up, and Tamils at that point tended to vote for the left. So they did not want it. And that is what led to trouble. Because where would this 7.5 lakh, nearly 8 lakh people go? It was a lot of people at that time. And India was already dealing with a population exchange with Pakistan, which was violent. So this continued for some time. For example, first, Sri Lanka passed Ceylon Citizenship Act, which the basic purpose of that law was to discriminate against these Indians. This was a 4 Feb 1948 law. Only those could be given citizenship who were third generation Indians, which means whose fathers had been born in Sri Lanka. That was very difficult for Indians to prove, because in many cases, Indian migratory labor tended to come back to India to deliver their babies. So then they took their babies back. So this generation's fathers, in many cases, were not born in Sri Lanka. What that meant was that under this law, only 5,000 of the 7,80,000 Indian plantation Tamils qualified for Sri Lankan citizenship. All the others were rendered stateless. Then there was pressure from Government of India, and later in 1948, they passed one more law. Where they said, all right, more Indian plantation Tamils can get citizenship, provided they've had 10 years of continuous living in Sri Lanka, or 7 years if they were married, and also if they passed a certain income threshold. That again was very onerous for these poor Indian plantation Tamils. In this, however, not just 5,000, but 1 lakh people qualified. So 1,05,000, what happens to the remaining 6,70,000, which by this time had also grown because populations grow, people produce babies. In 1947, Sri Lankan Parliament of 95 had 7 Tamils. Even that was not acceptable to Sinhala dominated government. So in 1949, they passed one more amendment. That is the Ceylon Parliamentary Elections Amendment Act number 49, which stripped Indians of the right to vote. That you could be citizens, but you will have no right to vote. So 1952 election, upcountry Tamils did not have even one MP. They had 0 MP in Sri Lankan Parliament. In the previous election, they had got 7 MPs. So that tamasha continued until the Nehru Kutelawala Agri Pact of 18 January 1954, when it was agreed that India will allow repatriation of Indian origin Tamils, but only on voluntary basis. Sri Lankans were insisting that they will first decide who will they give citizenship to, and anybody who does not qualify for their citizenship will automatically be given Indian citizenship. India insisted in this agreement, and that was accepted, that India will give citizenship only to those who voluntarily agree to be repatriated. Now, you know, it's very difficult for poor people just to be repatriated, thinking that, oh, that country will give me citizenship. This poor family has been in one country for 2 generations, maybe 3 generations, is very poor. It's very difficult for them to uproot themselves. That's why very few really came to India, and they continued in Sri Lanka as stateless citizens. Partial answer to this came up on 30th October 1964 under the Sri Mavo Shastri Pact. Sri Mavo Bandaranaike had now become Prime Minister of Sri Lanka. India-Sri Lanka relations had also improved. Lal Bahadur Shastri was doing a lot of repair work. Nehru had passed away. India was facing an imminent threat from the Pakistanis. The Pakistanis were being very belligerent. India had just seen the Hazrat Bal crisis in Kashmir. The war in Goa for the liberation of Goa, 1962 war had been lost. Indian armed forces were being reconstructed, rebuilt. So he signed this agreement with Sri Mavo Bandaranaike, in which India agreed to take back 5.25 lakh of these Tamils should they wish to come to India. Another 3 lakhs Sri Lankans now accepted as they are citizens. So they said they will give citizenship to 5.25 lakh will come back to India if they wanted to. And India agreed to give them citizenship. Not all of them came. The fate of 1.5 lakhs were still uncertain. This again festered. Then on 28th of June 1974, we cut to the Indira-Sri Mavo Pact, which was about Kacha Tivo, but the underlying understanding was that with this, the remaining 1.5 lakh Sri Lankan Tamils, plantation Tamils of Indian origin and their children who may have been born since 1964, they would also be given Sri Lankan citizenship. And that's how these stateless people found a home. Now, the fact is that Sri Lanka did not fully live up to its promises. And this tamasha went on in 1982. And that's when India-Sri Lanka relationship became really bad. This is when Mrs. Gandhi became very hostile to Sri Lanka. J.R. Jayawardene had come to power just before this. And the fact is that in his election campaigns, first time he became Prime Minister in the summer of 1977, that's the year Mrs. Gandhi lost her election. Then he became president. In his election campaign, he used a line. He said, look at these Indians. They are wonderful people. I mean, implication, I'm not quoting his words exactly, but basically complimenting the Indian people for rejecting, for throwing out the cow and the calf. Now, remember, the cow and the calf was then the election symbol of the Congress party. And he said, if Indians have thrown out the cow and the calf, why can't you Sri Lankans do it? So the reference was to Sri Mavo Bandaranaike and her son Anura. And that was his campaign line, which irritated Mrs. Gandhi a great deal. And the roots of the Sri Lankan insurgency and Indian support to it, I believe, lie somewhere there. So Mrs. Gandhi decided to be tough with him. In Sri Lanka by 1983, ethnic riots broke out. In 1988, under Rajiv Gandhi's pressure, after the Indo-Sri Lanka Accord, Sri Lanka passed another law. This is Jayawardene's government, called Grant of Citizenship to Stateless Persons Act, to all Indian Tamils. This now said this will apply to all Indian Tamils who hadn't applied for Sri Lankan citizenship earlier. Because you know what? It's very tough for human beings just to leave their homes and go to another country, even it happens to be their ancestors' native land. Then this was settled more or less on October 7, 2003, when Sri Lankan Parliament passed unanimously a new law called Grant of Citizenship of Persons of Indian Origin Act No. 35 of 2003, where all Indian Tamils resident or born in Sri Lanka since 1964, they had all been given citizenship. This now benefited 1,68,141 Indians who had been eligible for Indian citizenship, but were still staying there. All Indian Tamils now became Sri Lankan citizens. So these two movies played out together. When you see the problems that these stateless Indians were having, which started out with 7,80,000 in 1946, and the numbers then go up all the time because people produce babies. There was a grand bargain about their fate and welfare and also this territory. Now you might say that a bargain of territory for people is not such a good idea. It's an obscene idea. It's a good thing. It's a bad thing. Those are political and principled arguments that go on and on. But to understand one, you have to also follow the other, because one led to the other. And even now, if you see, for example, Jairam Ramesh's tweet explaining this and also calling out what he sees as the government's hypocrisy, he makes a reference to this, that it is after the Indira-Sri Mavo Agreement of 1974 that Indian plantation Tamils, who were rendered stateless, they got a just deal. So just as we try to understand territory, we have to understand this issue is not just about territory. The issue is about territory, but it's also about people. And it's also about a grand bargain. Now Sri Lankan plantation Tamils, they are doing all right, it seems. In fact, Sri Lanka is not a country we know very much about in India. We don't study it very much, except in terms of its politics, insurgency, things like that, but also in terms of its cricket. So who's the biggest cricket star Sri Lanka has produced? That Muthiah Muralidharan, he's a plantation Tamil, born to a family of plantation workers. His grandfather or great grandparents migrated to Sri Lanka from our Tamil Nadu. Muthiah Muralidharan, Russell Arnold, Roy Dias, the younger generation may not remember it, but since the 80s, he used to be a wonderful, wonderful, attractive and brilliant batsman who gave India a lot of trouble. Muthaiah Muralidharan, Roy Dias, and two players who we've seen more recently, that is Russell Arnold and Angelo Matthews. All of these are plantation Tamil. So these have become very much a part of Sri Lanka. In some ways, even more integrated than Jaffna Tamils. That said, we've also seen some references here made to the India-Bangladesh agreement on the exchange of enclaves. Now, the Congress now is hitting back at the BJP, saying that you are saying that we gave away this 1 square kilometer of land, which Indira Gandhi had described in 1968, and that is something that Jai Shankar mentioned today. She had described it as a little rock, sort of contemptuously, and he said that was like her father, Jawaharlal Nehru, describing Aksai Chin as a place where not a blade of grass grows. And who also, Nehru also in 1961 described this Kachativu issue as this little island which counts for nothing, where it's no more than a nuisance. And he said, I don't like these issues remaining pending and coming back again and again. So his point was that Congress Party gave away this territory, and Congress Party has a permissive attitude to Indian territory. So the Congress Party is now hitting back saying, but you signed an agreement with Bangladesh in which Indian territory was ceded to Bangladesh, and India actually lost more territory. There is, however, a more complex history to that one also that we need to understand. Today, we don't have the time to go into all of that. That was an agreement that was signed by the UPA government under Manmohan Singh. The BJP had blocked that agreement, unfortunately. So that agreement had to wait for Narendra Modi to come to power. And I would say that in larger national interest, and he deserves compliments for this, in 2015, he did ratify that agreement. And when he ratified that agreement, he said something really emotional and complimentary about this arrangement of embracing a neighbor and leaving out petty consideration while achieving a larger purpose. Now, 2013, when these talks with Sri Lanka were going on and the BJP in parliament was blocking this agreement, I had written a national interest article, which was then headlined, just a short newspaper headline in the Indian Express where it appeared, Dear Narendra Bhai. What did that national interest article say? You can see that article on your, screen. I will share a link with you. And in the course of time, maybe tomorrow, if not today, I will also record a video version of it. So you can see, you can access it more easily. And I'm doing that with some of my earlier articles, as you may have noticed. In that article, I said that, look, you know that this is in India's national interest. Bangladesh now has Sheikh Hasina, who's friendly to India after a long time. Bangladesh so far had Islamist regimes which are hostile to India and very friendly with Pakistan. She has gone out on a limb, catching your insurgents, catching your Alpha insurgents, others, and handing them over to you. She's also gone out on a limb, going after her own Jamaat-e-Islami and hanging them. And one of them escaped. Where did he go? He went to Pakistan and is living in the protection of Jaish-e-Mohammed. So what do you want? Do you want a relatively secular, liberal nation to your east? Or do you just want a Bengali-speaking Pakistan to your east? At that point, he did not intervene. But as we know, as soon as he came to power, that process started again. And the relationship between India and Bangladesh with that land boundary agreement, and with the land boundary agreement, India also settled its maritime boundary with Bangladesh. That's been one of the bigger foreign policy success stories of this government, I would say, because they completed it, but also a foreign policy success story of our rival parties working to common purpose.